chairs. So let's get the Joker, Mr. T, and Dr. Bashir to come sit here. That's let's have practice some anime and manga affirmative action. So you two ladies, if you want to come up and sit over there.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry if I repeat myself. I always hate doing that, but you know, there's people. I know what you want to hear. So questions that need to be answered. Second of all, who's here for the panel after them? Be brave. You can say it. Really? Okay. Because see, last year the room was filled, and half of them were for Orphan Black, and that's totally cool because you get a chance to meet me, and I get to talk about what I do. But like I said, we have a lot to get through. All right, before we talk about the Extinction Parade, before we talk about the Harlem Hellfighters, let us talk briefly about a movie that happened to have the same title as a book I once wrote. All right. Many years ago, write a book, World War Z, if you're Canadian, World War Z, okay. Hollywood comes, wow, we'd love to make a movie based on your book. I say, okay, give it a shot. 6 years later, a movie comes out. Now, let me start by saying that the reason I've never slammed a movie, and never will, because when you make a conscious deal with the Hollywood, you have no right to complain. Okay, you know who has a right to complain about Hollywood? Alan Moore. Because Alan Moore, I don't know if you guys know this, yes, you know that Alan Moore doesn't own the rights to those comics that they make a movie, all right? So what happens is, like, here's how Watchmen got made, okay? I have this on good authority. Hello, is this Alan Moore? Yeah, this is the Alan Moore who is a genius and brought comics to a new level and made it an actual art form and whose Watchmen is now in the Library of Congress. Yes, this is DC/Hollywood, and you can suck it. And that's pretty much what happened. Now, Alan had no say in that, so he can use this wonderful British profanity that they're so famous for and slam them. I can't do that because I made a conscious choice. No one put a gun to my head, so I just say, okay, I have to be a grown-up about these things, fine. Then the trailer came out. let me backtrack by saying, those of you who don't know World War Z, that's totally cool. I won't hold it against you. I'll just tell you what it was. I wanted to write a zombie book that was not your typical small person adventure story with some sort of alpha male hero who saves the world with a miracle cure. Then the trailer came out. Now, let me backtrack and also say, look, I get a lot of questions. People come and say, you know, what advice would you have for writers? Well, advice number one is write. Don't aspire, just write. I don't believe there's no aspiring writers. You could be an aspiring doctor or submarine commander, but you no excuse to be an aspiring writer. Just freaking write. But I also give advice, make sure that you marry the right person, okay? Because when you go into the art world, it will eat you alive. Because the truth is, people say, well, you shouldn't let things like get to you. Well, if I didn't let things get to me, I wouldn't be an artist, all right? I wouldn't be a writer. I'd be on Wall Street, you know, destroying the fabric of the American middle class. So, of course you're going to let things get to you. Of course you are. You're a writer. That is why most writers have either drowned in alcohol or suffocated themselves with mountains of cocaine. Because we're sensitive. That's how we are. Now, the alternative to that is you marry the right person who is your wingman, who is with you and knows you better than you know yourself. So, trailer comes out. Wow. And my wife says, look, call Frank Darabont. Now, you guys may not know this. Frank Darabont is a recent friend of mine. Those of you who have never heard the name Frank Darabont, have you heard of a show called Walking Dead? All right. Yay. You've got a bag right there. Let me tell you a little about Walking Dead. Okay? It started out as this indie comic, which was an awesome indie comic, but let's all take a step back and realize that as comic book people, we're not the mainstream, okay? We're like the Tea Party. We're this fringe that thinks we're the mainstream. Okay? Well, this indie comic comes out, it's great, it's awesome, but it's not mainstream. You know, housewives and regular folks with jobs and lives don't know about Walking Dead. Then this gentleman named Frank Darabont, who gave us a movie called The Shawshank Redemption, and The Green Mile, and The Mist, and pretty much everything that's awesome, said, I'm going to make a TV show. AMC is like, yeah, I'm going to make no TV show. Zombies, are you crazy? No. And he says, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to take my cast that I always work with, my writing staff I always work with, my production crew, which will save you money and time and works like a well-oiled machine, and I'm going to do it. Trust me. And so AMC is like, all right, trust him. Does anyone remember how AMC promoted the TV show Walking Dead before it actually came out? Do you remember their tagline? Trust us. That's literally what they said. Go online and Google it. You guys all know Google, okay? You know YouTube or whatever. It literally said, from the network that brought you Mad Men, from the director that brought you Shawshank, trust us. It comes out and it becomes a national sensation, okay? Now, how do you reward this man for believing in this comic book? If it were up to me, I would give him a statue on the mall in Washington, D.C., next to Martin Luther King. All right, there'd be Dr. King, and then there'd be Frank. AMC rewarded him by firing him. Yes, that's what they did. Because I don't know why, maybe they didn't want, like, a creator arguing for whatever. For whatever reason, they fired him. So the point is, Frank knows what it's like to get screwed. And by the way, if there's a Walking Dead panel here, please bring that up. And let's do a biological experiment called How Much Can We Make an AMC Executive Sweat? So I called Frank. I emailed Frank. And I said, hey, buddy, I'm in the trailer, Brad Pitt, make pancakes. And just So Frank emails me back. And he's so cool. He goes, look, buddy, take it from a screenwriter. Okay? A screenwriter who's had his work changed a lot. You have your book. Okay? And no one's ever messed with it, and no one ever will. Your book is pure, your book is you, and it's your side of the story. So no matter what that movie is, you will always have your book. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. Now, Frank did something even cooler. He then passed my email on to a friend of his, who then wrote him back and said, hey, tell your friend Max two things. Number one, I read World War Z and I liked it. And number two, tell him no matter what happens with the movie, people will hear about his book and people will read his book, and that's why we got into this. So people would read our books. All the best, Stephen King. And so, okay, I'm bucked up, I'm ready, and I go, and I go to the premiere in New York, and there's a big red Z, and everyone's like, oh, Brad, John Carter. No, I'm Max Brooks, thank you. And you know what happened, which was amazing? I watched a movie that had nothing to do with my book. Because look, when you're a writer and your book gets adapted, which is, I don't know, kind of in the way the Spaniards adapted Mexico. When your book gets adapted, you're terrified. I thought I was going to be sitting there tearing my hair out like Stephen King watching The Shining, watching your characters get mutilated, your story get eviscerated. you know what? They didn't destroy my book. They ignored it. Which is awesome. So I, you know, I got my book, nobody messed with it, and then I got to watch a really cool movie like 28 days later on crack. I also got to watch the greatest example of middle-aged housewife pornography ever made. Alright, and this is great because what they did marketing-wise, and this is very important. Brad Pitt is a genius, and I will give him credit for this. See, what they do a lot of times with aging stars is they keep trying to skew younger and younger with younger little teeny boppers. That only makes them look older and creepy. Okay? No, what they did was Brad was like, look, I made a ton of female fans in the 90s. Okay? And you, if there's any female here in your 40s, my age, you remember. You remember Legends of the Fall where it tips his hat and the little sunlight comes off? I took a date to that movie. Didn't work out so much.
You remind me of the Aiden Quinn character.
Thank you. But what he said was, those fans have now grown up, all right? They've gotten married. They have kids. Their priorities are different. So instead of making me like the bad boy, make me the hot husband, which they did. Because the truth is, if you want to get a middle-aged housewife excited, you don't have Brad Pitt from, you know, Thelma and Louise. You have Brad Pitt making pancakes. Good morning, dear. I'm just making breakfast for our lovely children. You're going to your very high-powered job? That's good. I had a high-powered job that I gave up for you because I love you. Why did I think of that? I mean, I saw, there's a scene, I don't know if you've seen the movie, there's a scene that I literally turned to my wife and said, did you write this part? Where they say, you have to go around the world and save the world for your family. But you have to call your wife every day. Wow. So the truth is, I have my book. They have their movie. They made a bajillion dollars on it. It didn't even go to China. Unbelievable. Like, they're making a next one, believe me. You know, but the battle for more money. And if that one goes to China, wow. Because let me tell you, the Chinese, and this is a true story, the Chinese actually only accept 12 movies a year from the United States. So that's why a lot of big blockbuster movies are kissing their ass so much now. Like, there's a yes, I know, so much for human rights. you saw new Transformers where they're fighting on the Great Wall? Oh, wait till Transformers 5, Optimus Prime versus Tibet. There's probably a scene where, like, Megatron transforms into a microblogger. I want free speech. You won't get away with that. Movie done, good for them, whatever, moving on. On a much smaller scale, many, many moons ago, a gentleman named William Christensen, who is Avatar, came to me about a short story I wrote called The Extinction Parade. And he said, I would like to turn this into a comic book series. And you don't have to do any work. You can just supervise. To which I thought, wow, cha-ching, or the comic book world, ching. But it was a journey of self-discovery because I started getting the scripts back for Extinction Parade and I realized they're brilliant, probably better than anything I could write, but they weren't me. Okay, so I started giving notes and my notes became rewrites and finally I said, William, we're gonna just pull the lever and break and then I'm gonna write it. I'm gonna write everything. Because it's gonna have, yes, if my name's gonna be on it, then it better be my work. So I started writing Extinction Parade, and here's what it's about. On the surface, it's zombies versus vampires. That's what it's supposed to be. It's a vampire plague, a zombie plague seen through the eyes of vampires. But that's not what it's really about. That's not why I wrote it. That's not why I'm interested in it. I'm interested in it because I'm 42 years old, and at this point in my life, I have learned the very important lesson that our weaknesses can be our greatest strengths. Because when I was growing up, all the kids who had to struggle and all the kids who had a rough time, whether you were the ugly kid or the poor kid, or in my case, the really dyslexic kid, all that compensating and all those survival skills and problem solving that we learned for these problems made us so much better adults. And it made us so much more capable of dealing with all the problems that are going to kick us in the face when we get older. There's an old expression, you want to make a man's life hard, make a boy's life easy. And that's exactly what happened. Because all the kids that I knew who had everything handed to them, either wealth, and not just wealth, beauty, the pretty girl who was like, I don't have to study or do anything, I'm just beautiful. Or the athlete who could snap a ball and was like, what do I need with anything else? Me big. They became grown-ups, and problems happened, and they had no history of struggle or adaptation. And they are doomed. And I thought, wow, what if we applied that to a whole species? Vampires. Because if growing up, to me, vampires were always sort of cool and hot and sexy and everyone wanted to be a vampire. To me, I look at them and I say, get a job. Because they never did anything for themselves. They never had to work. Yes, see? You get it. You guys all seen the movie Underworld? Remember how I love Underworld? I do. And that scene when they first drive to the Gothic mansion and there's all like the vampires just sort of hanging out in the big mansion, I thought, who pays the property taxes on this? When the lights go out or the toilet gets stopped up, like, who calls the plumber? Who does the work that keeps lives going? And so that's the extinction parade, is you have these sort of spoiled, arrogant, completely useless, helpless vampires. Yes, see both of you. Vampires. And they're living the high life. And then the zombies start rising. And initially, they love it. Because recently, vampires have been hemmed in by human civilization. And I don't just mean technology. In my world, the vampire's biggest enemy is something called the middle class. Because, you know, vampires, they used to kill whoever they want. There was the 1% that they couldn't touch, because that was like, you know, the clergy or, you know, the aristocracy or whatever. Everybody else was fair game. You can go to hell. But in the last century, what? Average citizens have worth? You're telling me that I have to be careful who I kill? Because if I just kill someone with a job and a credit card and a social security number and a boss who's going to call the cops the next day, I can't do that? So they've been feeling suffocated. So when the vampires start to destroy human civilization, they love it. It's like Mardi Gras for them. And they also think, hey, we better kill as much as we can, as fast as we can, because eventually the humans are going to get their house in order and the zombies are going to go away, right? Uh-uh. They have an inconvenient truth, which they realize that the zombies are not destroying human civilization. They're destroying humanity. And when they destroy humanity, what are the vampires going to eat? Oops. And they realize, oh my God, we need to take a hand in our own destiny and fight to survive. But we have no history of fighting, and we have no history of organizing, and we have no history of problem solving. In fact, we have no history of doing anything hard. Oh my God, we don't just need to learn how to survive, we need to learn how to learn. But the question is, can they do it in time? Because I like to say that my vampires had really bad parents. Mother Nature and Father Time. Mother Nature said, oh, you've got all these wonderful gifts, speed, strength, agility, the ability to heal. Don't worry, you just depend on those. You don't need to develop any new coping mechanism. You got those. And Father Time said, hey, I'll always be here for you. You're going to have all the time in the world. I'll always be here to take care of you. And then one day he's not. He's abandoning them. Oops. That is the extinction parade. Can these vampires, who have been so long at the top of the food chain, realize what it takes to survive before it's too late? That is what we're doing right now with Avatar. We've just done issues 1 through 5, Act 1, in trade paperback. Issue number 6, or 1 of 2, is called War. This is when the vampires actually go to war, and then they realize, oh, wow, declaring war is very different than actually having to fight a war. And that is really, really hard on them. It's the first time they come up against their limitations and realize, oh, we're actually not the super beings we thought we were. And many of you understand this. Many of you don't realize your strengths and weaknesses until you're actually tested. So you actually have to go out there and realize, oh, I'm not as good at this as I thought I was. Or in my case, when I left my Jewish high school and got into college, I realized, I'm not as tall as I thought I was. But you don't know what you can do until you get out there and you're tested. And that is so because not only am I middle aged, I'm a parent. And I'm a parent in a generation of parents that never teach their kids to fail. This is a generation now coming up behind me where both soccer teams get trophies, no matter who wins and who loses. This is a generation, and I'm not kidding, who call their parents to call their professors in college to complain about their grades. Yes, this is a generation who, and I'm not kidding, go with their parents to job interviews. They really do this now. This generation has been so coddled and so emotionally spoiled, they have never had to do anything. And that's why when you watch a show like Girls, they're all just like, oh God, we're so rich and spoiled, and yet life, we're whining, oh God, life is so hard. To which, you know, the Iraqi girls are like, oh, I have such sympathy for you. Wow, it's so hard to not be killed. And have food in your stomach every night, and money from your parents. Oh, so much sympathy. Hey, look, Rwanda, look, there's a show called Girls. Ah, American, oh, life is so hard. This generation coming up behind me has this expression, epic fail, right? Everything's like an epic fail, which is kind of ironic because every time I've heard that expression, it's never used for like real epic fails like Hurricane Katrina. They're always used for like, oh man, Phantom Menace was an epic fail. No, it was annoying, but it was not an epic fail. And by the way, epic fail is a good thing, because if you never epically fail, you will never epically learn. You will never epically adapt. I always said the best thing Lorne Michaels did for me for Saturday Night Live, other than hire me, was fire me on my honeymoon. True story. I'm an island in the South Pacific. How did they lay fiber optic cable all that way so Lorne Michaels could tell me to suck it? But I learned. You have to epically fail, and vampires never did. So let's see if they have time. Other projects I'm working on? Well, I've already done it. You guys know Zombie Survival Guy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, you guys know I wrote it like in the 90s, right? I didn't write it when Zombies were popular. I wrote it for me, and I didn't write it to be published. Before I even wrote Zombie Survival Guy, I wrote a movie, which I thought would be interesting. It's a true story. True story. Because before I'm a sci-fi nerd, horror nerd, whatever, I'm a history nerd. There's a lot of us out there. I got into it for the women. There was a war. I don't know if you guys know this, but before World War II, you guys heard of World War II, right? All right, we're Americans, all right? We don't even know who won the first American Isle anymore. Before World War II, there was something called World War I. All right, and in World War I, and this is important, do you know that was the first war that we fought for ideals? It's the same national debate we're still having today. Because why do Americans go fight? Why? We have two oceans protecting us. I won't say we have friendly neighbors to the north or the south, but what are they going to do? especially the Canadians. But what are they going to do? So we have no reason to go to war. And we knew that in World War I. So President Wilson said, we're going for ideals. We're going to make the world safe for democracy. Unfortunately, in 1917, democracy wasn't exactly safe at home. I don't know if you guys know this. In World War I, when we went to go fight to make the world safe for democracy, women couldn't vote. Really, women couldn't vote till 1920. There was also another section of the population. Let's call them black people. And this is an important time in American history, okay? Because in the North, we were like, you've got to free the slaves. Free them, yes, freedom, and they should be treated like people, and yes, and freedom. Oh my God, they're coming up here? Wait, whoa, no, you tipped it. White power! So in 1917, when black people were trying to come up to the North to get jobs, the US government just browned their shorts with terror. And as a result, when we went to go to war to make the world safe for democracy, there was a group of African-American soldiers who were like, yes, we're going to make the world safe for democracy, and by the way, once we're done, we're going to come home and make sure that it's safe at home. And the U.S. government said, oh God, no. No, you're not. So the United States government set up its own soldiers to lose. They gave them poor weapons, poor training. They sent them to Spartanburg, South Carolina, hoping there'd be a race riot, because there had been a race riot literally 2 weeks before with another unit. They weren't allowed to march off to war in triumph, because look, I don't know if anybody here has ever served. It's Comic-Con, how many of us actually have? I mean, look,
I'll say my military experience was ROTC in Desert Storm, which I'll give you an impression of me as a soldier. Okay. That was how I served Uncle Sam. But for men and women who actually do march off to war, there's a time-honored truth, which is you get to march off in a parade. And that's important to every soldier. March off, the band plays, the people cheer out of windows, because it tells you we're behind you. Well, in World War I, all the New York National Guard units were put together in something called the Rainbow Division, and they marched off to war in triumph. This Black National Guard unit was not allowed to march along with the Rainbow Division because they were told black is not a color of the rainbow. So they were sabotaged, humiliated, set up to fail. When they were brought overseas, they were made to dig ditches. And then when they demanded to be sent into combat, we did the ultimate insult. We gave them to the French. Yeah, I know. Now the French, first of all, the French had great luck with its African troops, so in their reverse racism, they probably thought, oh my God, black people can fight, thank you. But also, when you're desperate, you don't have the luxury of prejudice. And that's really true. You know, what's the only good thing about war is when you get really desperate, you have to get rid of all your prejudices because you have to win the war, and you have to do crazy things, like let women work or let black guys fight. So the French said, hey, anybody who can hold a rifle will take you. Well, this unit that had been so degraded came home as one of the most decorated units in the entire United States Army. Mm. The first American to win the French Croix de Guerre, black or white, one of them. The whole unit won the Croix de Guerre. And when they came home, they marched in a parade where a million New Yorkers turned out to welcome them. I tried to get this made as a movie for years. I was told, are you crazy? And so finally, when I met William and I got the comics, I said, you know what, this is going to be my next project. Because I don't have to worry about Hollywood. And you know what? It doesn't matter how great a script is if it sits in a drawer. I don't care if 100 people read this comic book, okay? It lives, it exists, it's out there. And so it's called The Harlem Hellfighters. It just came out, and 2 weeks before it came out, Hollywood came calling. Mm-hmm. And now I'm writing the movie script for Will Smith's company. Raise your hand and let's do this.
There's also a mic right
there. There's a mic where you can just stand up and shout. Yes, sir. Hand went right up. Go for it.
If you could do it again, who would you have to do the World War Z movie?
Who would I have? Okay. See, given that exists in the ether, like, all right, if you could command the Battlestar Galactica or the Pegasus, which one? So as long as we're going into pure fantasy, you know who I would have? Erwin Allen. The guy with the gray hair is like, yeah! The one baby boomer. For those of you youngins who don't know, there was a time called the 1970s. And there was a man named Erwin Allen. He was the king of disaster movies. And he was awesome because what he did was he took all these actors who were famous in the 1950s and needed a job, and he put together these awesome all-star casts. So it was cameos by everybody in movies like Earthquake and the Poseidon Adventure, and I think there was like a volcano on an island once.
Tower
Inferno. Did he do The Swarm as well? Killer Bees. So trust me, if I could dig him up and plug him into a battery and Mr. Allen, World War Z, oh, it would be awesome. The cameos would be amazing. He'd probably reanimate Lauren Green just to be in it. So that's who I would have. Yes, you have a question, young lady.
Hi, my name's Lindsay.
Hello, Lindsay.
I'm one of those people that discovered you because of the movie.
See? Stephen King was right.
Yes. And my background is public health.
Oh,
and
Lord, I'm sorry.
No, but actually, that's why I really enjoyed World War Z, is how nuanced the social, economic, and cultural implications of what is essentially a public health crisis. So I'm wondering what kind of research you did or didn't do on maybe the subject of plagues or just...
No, I mean, look, a lot of the research I did was just basic disaster preparedness. I mean, everyone asked me, like, did you watch all the zombie movies? No, I watched one zombie movie, which is 1978 Romero's Dawn of the Dead, greatest zombie movie ever made. That's all I did. Growing up, being dyslexic, it took me a while to read. So the first book I ever read was Red October by Tom. Clancy. And Clancy got rid of all that Ian Fleming crap and made it real. Because I like to walk away from stuff smarter. As someone who didn't get along well at school, I like to learn as well as be entertained. So when I did World War Z, I thought, what would a real zombie plague look like? So I looked at how plagues are dealt with by public health, you know, over the years. Which, by the way, here's a fun little tidbit that you already know that the rest of you don't. If we were about to have a nuclear war, would you cut our strategic bombing wing by a third? Our air defense by a third? We're at war with, there's terrorists right now that would love to blow us all up. Would you cut our anti-terror budget by a third? Of course you would. That would be stupid. So why in an age where plagues are more common than they've ever been, did the US Congress cut the Center for Disease Control by a third? Sleep well, everybody. And this is, because this is a big problem in this country. Just as human population is exploding, just as trade is bringing us all together, just as people can get out of the jungles of Africa, get on a plane, be in New York in 24 hours, we're cutting all the basic human services that keep us from getting more planes. We used to be really good at that. And it's not just those crazy right-wing libertarians, who, by the way, I think should all go live in Somalia for a year. It's also freaking lefty hippies who are like, I don't want to get my child vaccinated because Jenny McCarthy told me about it. Because I think the next plague that comes, and it will come, will be very preventable and will be our fault.
I think your depiction was incredibly realistic.
Thank you. Too much so. Thank you.
My friend recommended World War Z to me, and so I went home and I read it. And then I came to school like 3 or 4 days later, and I talked to my friend, and we're like, this should be a TV series. And have you ever thought that it should be a TV series, because it, like, it has so many different points of view, it would probably work a lot better as a TV series than a movie?
Oh yeah, no, I think it would be great. I have a whole idea for it, and I found it right next to my Israeli-Palestinian peace plan. Because it probably has about as much chance of being listened to. Yeah, I mean, look, of course, we would love to do all, I mean, but we live in the world we live in, okay? You know, we live in a world where that's Hollywood, fine, whatever. I would love it to be that way too. I would also love to do a comic book where Ellen Ripley kills Bella from Twilight. speaking of the, okay, William wants me to mention this. Look, I have optioned the television rights for Extinction Parade for a TV show. Now that doesn't mean it's gonna get done, okay? This just means that we're talking about it and playing with ideas. So I do, this is the thing, now that World War Z has come out and I have a little more mojo behind me, now I can actually have more creative control. Mm-hmm. Like with Extinction Parade, if it ever does go, I have a shot legally of writing the pilot. So hopefully that will go. And I've already said to the people I'm in business with, we need to go pure or we need to go home. Because I don't need a TV show. What I need is my ideas to be right. So let's hope for that. Yes, sir.
Just a question about the setting in World War Z. Why Cape Town? Why Kailicha? Why the townships? I mean, it works, and it shows a really good environment, as Petri dish do it, where the infection can just roll on really, really quickly. But there are a lot of areas like that in the world. Any particular reason why Cape Town?
Yeah, I did Cape Town for a couple of reasons. I did Cape Town because, number one, because of what's happening with AIDS in South Africa, and how AIDS is just rampant. And by the way, like, see, I thought in the 19—I lived through AIDS in the 1980s. Like, all you young people now, like, you understand. Like, especially men, you understand if for some wonderful reason you actually get to touch a breathing girl. You know the dangers involved, right? You know what could happen, and if you don't protect yourself, that's your problem. When I was a kid in the 80s, it was just starting. Now, AIDS could have been wiped out with a pamphlet. If our president in 1980 had been like, well, my fellow Americans, there's a disease, if you wear a thing on your thing, you'd be all right. He didn't do that. So AIDS got out of the bottle. And then it got rampant in Africa. And then the South African government made us look even smarter by saying, oh, you can pray it away, or you, in Toronto, the World Health Conference in Toronto, you know what the South African Ministry of Health recommended for AIDS? Yeah, garlic and beetroot. What? So that was one reason. Another reason was South Africa, when I was a kid, some of you don't know this about South Africa, they essentially held apartheid, which meant there was like 100 white people and 100 million black people. And the white people were always rightfully scared that the black people would rise up and kill them. So they trained every young South African child mandatory target practice. I remember watching a training video of that when I was a kid, and I thought, wow, if any country would be paranoid enough to have an anti-zombie plan, it would totally be that. So that's why I chose South Africa.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Thank you. Yes?
I watched you on The Deadliest Warrior when you did the Gathering versus Zombies.
Yes, okay, for those of you who don't understand, there's a show called Deadliest Warrior, where it's like, what if a ninja fought a Spartan? Bam! And they did it, and they took it seriously. And it was like an Apache fighting a Spartan, and they had this, the Apache Snake Walker, and they had Snake Walker fighting a dude dressed as a Spartan. And, well, they finally said, we need to do zombies versus vampires, because there's a portion of people who watch the show that are still getting laid. So they had me and Matt Mocha, the Zombie Research Society, Team Zombie. They had Steve Niles, 30 Days of Night, and a dude who looks like Christian Slater is Team Vampire. And we actually like ran through computer simulations and studied scientific probabilities, and zombies lost. Okay. But it's funny you say that, because it was when I was on Deadliest Warrior, I'd already written the Extinction Parade short story. It was already out there. But I realized there was so much more I wasn't saying. And as I was arguing with the vampire guys, I realized, wait a minute, the problems of the vampires are not physical, because they were all going very physical. You know, infection versus speed versus ability to heal. I said, no, this is not physical. This is psychological. That's the enemy of the vampires. Because zombies do what zombies do. They're not sentient. They're a walking disease. Whereas vampires, they can lose. They have the ability to screw themselves and have the wrong psychological skill set. And that is where Extinction Parade, the comic book, came from. Thank you. Yes, miss. I wrote it for me. I literally wrote to keep myself sane, because I was a struggling screenwriter, and I would go on these pitch meetings with these functionally, mentally challenged people called creative executives, and they would read my scripts, and they would say, yeah, that's really interesting. World War I. Okay, listen. We love it. It's great. But we have a deal with Freddie Prinze Jr. So, this is the 90s. Can you make it funny? And so, instead of going home and punching a wall, I said, I'm going to write something for me. So, I did. I stuck it in a drawer. And I met a book agent who said, I read your manuscript. I can get that published. And I'm like, and you do that. Which, the moral of that story is, don't ever challenge Tom Wolfe's book agent to write it. And what else? Yes?
What non
Oh, how about Twilight not only setting back the feminist movement, but the suffragette movement as well?
Woo!
Because look, I was not a feminist. I really wasn't. My mother was a strong woman. My mom had her own career. My mom had actually at one point took care of my dad when he wasn't working. So when I used to hear women, especially in college, be like, making strong female role models, I'd be like, yeah, whatever. Like, let me lie. That's great. Go back to like the 50s. That war is won. And then I saw Twilight. Wow! And the lessons oh my God. So, okay, lesson number one, find a bad boy. Number two, tease him sexually. Number three, get him to get in a fight with another bad boy to fight over you. Number four, do self-destructive behavior so you can ignite his sense of taking care of you because you can't do anything for yourself. Lesson number 5, get pregnant at 18. Oh my God. Yes, we really do need strong female role models. Lots and lots and lots of them. With the beard, Sons of Anarchy, yes.
Okay. If you could go back in time and do the whole Hollywood World War Z thing over again, would you?
Oh, what, you mean would I make the deal again?
Would you have done it different or would you have done it at all?
I would do it differently.
Right?
Here's what I would have done. I would have gone on Zoloft then. That's what I would have done. And then I would have been like, hey, whatever, I'm totally fine. Yeah, that's what I would have done. Because the truth is, because of this movie, you know, people have seen my book now. A lot more people are reading my words. And it also provided me, let's be honest, people really do sell out. Yeah, you know what? It's the money I've made on my World War Z book and Zombie Survival Guide book that allowed me to write Harlem Hellfighters. Because the truth is, when you hit it big, you come to a fork in the road. And that fork in the road is you can either keep making more money. I could have written World War Z Part 2 and really cashed in, and it would have sucked balls, and you would have known it, and I would have known it. Or I can take this financial cushion now that my child is fed, my house is paid off, and I can see whatever doctor I want in this country, and I can use that time and write what I want to write and follow my passion, because it's my passion that got me here in the first place. So, in a way, yes, I am grateful for the ability to do the Harlem Hellfighters. You know, literally, I just found out the other day, in Harlem Hellfighters, you'll see the true story of a man named Henry Johnson, first American to win Croix de Guerre. Had he been white, we've got the Medal of Honor on the spot. He's just been put up for the Medal of Honor, like a week ago. If he gets it, wow. So if I wouldn't have been able to write Harlem Hellfighters or Extinction Parade or G.I. Joe Hearts and Minds or any of the things I do, if I was concerned with feeding my family, and if I had to hustle and feed my family, okay. So yeah, believe me, I am not thrilled when I hear lines like, "You're asking me to leave my family. Don't pretend your family's exempt." I don't get exactly excited when I heard the trailer on Entertainment Tonight going, "Coming up, the world's infested by zombies and only Brad Pitt can save us." But I made my choice and I accepted the consequences. And maybe I would do it again. Anyone else?
Yes.
Dr. Bashir, yes.
So my background is in psychologist, and I one of the reasons why I love World War Z, the book, is because of all the cultural differences, and I want to check out Extinction Parade because it sounds like you're talking about resilience.
Yeah,
I mean, there's real research that people used to think kids who grew up in urban environments are worse off, and research is the opposite.
No, in fact, I don't know if you know this. Do you guys know this? In Vietnam, the highest percentage of kills was from white kids from the suburbs. And the highest percentage of survivors, black kids from the ghetto, because black kids from the ghetto, when they heard gunshots, knew to frickin' duck. Whereas white kids from the suburbs grew up with John Wayne movies. So when they heard the shooting, they thought they were in Sands of Iwo Jima. Oops.
So I'm wondering if you might take on, I think, one of the most interesting issues and our possible extinction event, which is climate change.
Oh God, you know, listen, this is one of the reasons, and this is very important, why in Extinction Parade, I made the zombies ignore the vampires. See, because if the zombies went after the vampires, that would jumpstart their sense of self-preservation. No, I wanted it to not be a primary threat, but a secondary threat, which is what global warming is. Nobody's going to die from global warming. You see the South Park episode where they're all like, "Oh, we got to get away from the global warming." That stupid movie where Jake Gyllenhaal is running from the ice age. No, I think the notion of things that can kill us by destroying our environment, by destroying the world we live in, that's Extinction Parade. The zombies are not going to kill the vampires. They're going to kill the world that preserves the vampires. Believe me, you know, and we've known this for a while, so that's one of the reasons I did it. Anyone else?
Here.
Yes.
Which advices would you put in a book like How to Survive to a Gay Attack?
How would I survive a gay attack?
Yeah.
You know, like if you're a gay guy and there's a bunch of hillbillies trying to kill
no,
you?
No.
Oh, but no, that's really important because listen, I do some lectures on colleges and I talked to one of the advisors and she was the advisor of like the LGBSU and she said, yeah, the biggest problem is the gay kids now, they don't want you to use pronouns, all right? They're very label conscious, okay? They don't want, that really offends them if you call them Mr. or Miss or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? They got bigger problems in this backward, hate-filled country. Matthew Shepard wasn't killed by a fucking pronoun, all right? They better spend a little less time with labels and more on their taekwondo.
I was telling that because the religious, they blame gays for everything.
Oh, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Listen, why do you think AIDS got out of control in this country in the 1980s? It's because the people in power... Look, you don't remember this. I remember it. I remember the religious right in this country being like, excellent. Yes, finally God shall smite the sodomites. Thanks, guys. Yeah, because if there's one thing Jesus is not known for, it's compassion. No, believe me, don't get me started on that one, the religious right. Go talk to Gomorrah. We got 5 minutes. Yes!
I'm just curious why the Brad Pitt movie studio actually bought your title if they weren't going to listen to the book.
It never starts out that way.
Was there intention to follow your story, or do you think they just wanted
to... No, here's what happened. Here's what I think. I don't know. I wasn't involved. What I suspect was, you know, when Brad Pitt first optioned World War Z, he wasn't going to star in it. Okay? He was going to produce it. So when he's going to produce something, it's smaller budget, smaller profile, whatever. Once Brad Pitt signs on to star, that kicks it into a whole new world. The summer blockbuster is a genre to its own. And by the way, given that the gold standard of that genre is Michael Bay, I think the movie was pretty freaking good by comparison. Yes. Extinction Parade is at the Avatar booth,
2701.
It's in Hall C. Okay, what's it nearby? The big, you know, when you go in the corner and there's all the T-shirts. All right. It's right next to that. That's where you can get Extinction Parade.
And Max will be signing immediately after.
Literally, I'm walking from this to go sign it. Anyone else? We only got a few more minutes. Yes, sir, and a half.
I was wondering what your favorite book is.
My favorite book? Oh, God. I mean, I read them all. I read them all, please. I'm just a freaking dyslexic. Thank God for audiobooks. I can tell you what I'm reading now. I'm reading the graphic novel series Scout, which is amazing. Which, I come late to these things. I literally, before that, I just read Alan Moore's Swamp Thing. Oh, my God, you're such a genius. Because the truth is, look, when you break through and you become successful, you get to meet other successful people, you realize half of them are just freaking frauds who just fall ass backwards into success. They don't know what they're doing. And the worst part is some of them don't even care. They're just counting their money. But Alan Moore, who I've yet to meet, or just too scared to meet, from what William tells me, he's the real deal. Like, he's really a genius. I mean, the man took a freaking walking plant and made him an awesome superhero. So that's what I'm reading now. I love Scout. Scout is amazing. Oh, boy. I don't often feel this way, but when I read something that makes me feel like I'm in the wrong business and I'm the fraud in the room, then I know that this is good. Yeah. So check it out. Anyone else? Yes, in the way back. Hand was way up. Last question. What childhood horror movie did not give me nightmares? My son, who's 9 years old, Henry, he loves to ask me about them because he thinks it's really cute that I had nightmares. Okay, I'll tell you a quick story, which I tell my son, which he loves to hear. When I was a kid, there was something called the Z channel, which meant it was the one cable channel. We were very well off in my house. We had a box with 13 buttons with a cable that ran to the TV. And it was 13 buttons, channel 1 through 13, and the cable channel. And my parents were like, don't you ever watch it. Don't ever watch it. And I was like, oh, please, their parents, what do they know? I'm 9 years old. So I'm watching it, and I turned up a movie, and it was called The Omen 2. Oh, my God. So literally, this is a true story. I watched a scene where the old lady
Sylvia, Cindy's in the bed, and a raven comes in and looks at her, and you hear, oh, blur, blur, blur. Ah! Oh my God! Dad! I made my parents move the bed around the room so I wouldn't be facing a window. now here's where I'm at. I will end up telling you why I had the greatest mother in the world. Because, you know, a father's attitude is this. We have two speeds, which is, how can I help? I'll help. I'm a father. And then when that runs out of steam, they go, just get over it. Alright? That's a father. Then my father's like, I'll do it. I'll move your bed. What? You want me to move your bed here? Now you want me to move here? You know what? You need to get over the goddamn raven. Not moving your bed anymore. I was in World War II. You know how many strangers I make laugh. So my mother, who most of you don't know, her name was Anne Bancroft. This older guy, he knows her. He knows her as Mrs. Robinson, America's first proto MILF. Here's what my mother did for me. She used my imagination to help me instead of hurt me. She said, yes, the raven's real, but he can't touch you with this. And she took a plastic lightning bolt and took glow-in-the-dark stars and stuck it on there because she knew my imagination could not be conquered with reality. So she said, as long as you have this lightning bolt above your bed, raven can't touch you. And guess what? Never had a nightmare again. That was my
mother. 2701.
2701, we're going. Thank you.